This week on Retronauts, when you see a hunchback, you must whip it. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts, episode 315. I counted this time, and I am Jeremy Parrish, counting for once, and I am here in North Carolina without other people. They're in other places. Yes, we're recording this under pandemic protocols. We're going to be doing episodes like this, I think, for a very long time. And that's sad, but what's not sad is that this is going to be a fun episode with fun people on a fun topic that we all love. And it's going to be great. So who do I have? Who's the regular calling in from California?
Hey, T-Frog, far from the West Coast. This is Shane Bloody Tears Bettenhausen. Happy to be back in quarantine. We're taping this in week 10 of quarantine for our listeners in the distant future.
Hopefully distant future. I think people will remember this year pretty well, even if everything turns out well, even if everything is good again, people are going to remember this.
We're
going to
be optimistic and imagine that future Castlevania historians, are looking back on this time. So yes.
But Shane, have you talked to a doctor about that, tear issue you've got?
It's a tear issue I don't want to get rid of because it's a jam.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's a total jam.
All right. And who else is that?
This is Nadia Oxford from US Gamer, staff writer and co-host of the Acts of the Blood God podcast, and I promise to be fun as hell.
Wow, fun as hell.
Whoa.
Amazing.
Hell yeah.
She promises not to be depressing at all.
Nope.
I work at it.
Well, the thing is, this is a good topic to be fun about, because again, it is a series that we all love, and that is Castlevania for NES. Now, you may be saying to yourself, Jeremy Parrish, you have already recorded an episode on NES Castlevania. How dare you? But, sir, that was like 7 years ago. That was a long time ago.
That was forever. That was ancient history.
7 years is actually 70 years in pandemic time. And on top of that, we have a different perspective on this now. There's things that have come to light, things that I personally have played finally that I'd never had the opportunity to try before. So this is not like the previous one we did a long time ago, 2013, I believe, was the NES Castlevania trilogy. This is not that. This is just NES Castlevania. And this being a time of hardship for many people and great stress and frustration, we just wanted to do episodes, you know, some episodes on topics that are near and dear to us and try to bring a different perspective to things. So I think we'll be able to do that. I think that will work this time. And so we're going to jump right in, and we're talking about not only Castlevania for NES, but also the other versions of that game. By my count, there are four other versions of NES Castlevania for other platforms. You know, we're not talking about ports. We're talking about other attempts to create a game based around sort of the structure and template and content of NES Castlevania, because that was kind of the progenitor. You know, it came out first, and Konami has gone back to the well many times. Like, they went back many times within the space of less than a decade to say, let's do that again. And
I think I just want to interject. I think that unique revisionist take at the time is one of the reasons that I think made me like the series so much, because there wasn't a lot of that in the 80s and 90s. It was still pretty new, you know?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, this was before reboots were even a thing.
Right. Sequels were still kind of new, let alone multiple remakes.
Right. And they did eventually try to do the reboot thing with Castlevania Lords of Shadow, but that doesn't count.
Right.
This is something different. This is basically them just saying, like, we created this game for a system based around the limitations of that system at the time, but what if we took that idea, that concept, and explored it with new technology, with, you know, the ability to do more, and see where it goes. Yeah. And so that's where you have the five games that we're talking about this episode: NES Castlevania, Vampire Killer for MSX2, Haunted Castle for arcades, Super Castlevania 4 for Super NES, and Akumajo Dracula, aka Castlevania Chronicles, for X68000 home computers.
Ah, what a wonderful lineup. I'm excited.
I am very excited myself.
Shane, I think you were about to say something.
Well, I was going to say that Castlevania NES is unique that at that time, and I think you and I are old enough vintage to remember what it was like when it was new, there it wasn't too far apart from the arcade versus Castlevania, and, you know, we later find out Vampire Killer almost at the same time, which is fairly weird that, like, all these things kind of came together simultaneously, and also Haunted Castle, you know, a few years later. But, like, the fact that 2.5 similar games were all made at the same time early on is a weird thing, and, like, that's always struck me as strange. And, like, I think both of us came to Vampire Killer much later, and it's almost impossible to imagine what it was like to have played that on its original release, I think.
I would just like to interject and say I am older than God, and I own it. So I understand all the retro talk.
So how did the two of you first come to know Castlevania? Like, for myself, it was not really a series that I paid any attention to, or a game that I paid any attention to, until I saw previews for Castlevania 2 in Nintendo Power and said, whoa, that looks interesting.
Screenshots of Castlevania in, you know, Fun Club News did nothing for young Jeremy Parrish. You're like, oh, a side-scroller with a barbarian fighting.
Fun Club News did not exist at that point, sir. This was 1987, 88.
Okay, well, so you didn't know that Castlevania existed.
There weren't magazines aside from Nintendo Power. And this game came out before Nintendo Power.
Right.
And so it wasn't featured in Nintendo Power. It was only in the official player's guide, which I didn't get until later.
Okay.
So, you know, just going by the artwork on the front, I was like, well, I like the silver, but I don't know. Name sounds stupid.
Did you not have a mom and pop rental shop where you could rent everything?
No, rental shops weren't a thing at that point. We're talking really early.
Jeremy, I grew up in the holler. I'm from Kentucky. We had rental shops by 1987, I'm pretty sure.
We had rental shops, but they didn't start selling video or, like, offering video games, at least not that I'm aware of, for a while.
Wow, I find that so intriguing that you literally did not know about Castlevania until Castlevania 2.
I also did not get an NES. I could not find one to buy until, like, New Year's 1988. So almost immediately after, you know, they started promoting Castlevania 2, you know, by that summer. And I was like, whoa, this seems really interesting. And being the nerd that I am, I'm like, I need to go back and play the first one.
I'll say that perspective I find really interesting, because that's a perspective that people don't think about, that back then, you know, pre-internet, pre-games being super mainstream, like, a good game could exist, be kind of popular, and you literally wouldn't know it existed at all.
Oh, yeah, that happened to me all the time. Like, I got my NES quite late, so I missed out on a lot of really popular games until the 90s.
Yeah, discoverability was definitely not what it is back then that it is today. And so, yeah, as a result, I was intrigued. And so I was like, I need to find this game and play it. And it was really hard, because back then you had chip shortages. And so I looked high and low, literally across the country, until it took me months to finally find it. But once I did, I was not disappointed. It was exactly what it was better than what I had hoped. It was really just shockingly good. But yeah, Nadia, how did you come to be smitten by the Castlevania bug?
Well, it's funny. I'm a little bit similar to you in that I actually first played Castlevania 2, and that was at a sleepover. My friend's brothers were playing Castlevania 2, and I was just, like, fascinated by the whole adventure aspect of it. And Castlevania 2 was actually a good game for someone like myself, who at the time was extremely bad at platforming. So I went from Castlevania 2 to 3, and that confused me, because 3, of course, is very much like 1, and I'm like, what's going on here? Why isn't this Castlevania? I don't know what's going on. And it's funny, I actually did not play the original honest-to-God Castlevania until it came out on the Wii console, the virtual console.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
And I actually did okay with that until I got to Frankenstein.
That's the stopping point for most people.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so in effect, I actually played Symphony and every probably like all of its or most of its accompanying games before I played the original Castlevania.
Huh.
Wow.
Shane, how about yourself?
So I got my NES in 87, and Castlevania was, you know, a game that I hadn't seen in stores, and I hadn't heard anything about it. And then I was at church, you know, in Sunday school, and I heard kids talking about it on the playground. talking about the Grim Reaper and like trying to beat the Grim Reaper.
Talking about demons in church. I love it.
Like literally, I heard them like, oh, the Grim Reaper, it's so hard. I can't beat the Grim Reaper. And then one kid's like, you have to use holy water. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, it's this cool game called Castlevania. I was like, that sounds amazing. So I started looking for it at, you know, all the toy stores. No one had it. And it was like this holy grail, right? And like, I dreamed of it. And then finally, like, I think then a video store, like Movie Warehouse, opened up. It started, had NES games, had it. I rented it there. And I couldn't get past the mummies, I think.
Mummies, really?
Yeah, which aren't even that hard, right? But yeah. I was a kid, it was hard. And
okay,
like,
fair enough.
But I really liked it. I remember, like, I thought the controls were a little wonky compared to, like, Super Mario Brothers or, you know, Ghosts and Goblins or something. But I dug the music, I dug the graphics. And, like, there's just something inscrutable about it. Like, just the approach to the, you know, the old movie monsters. So, yeah, I was immediately in love with it. And I kept renting it over and over again. And I eventually got to the Grim Reaper, but couldn't beat him. And then someone rented and kept it, so it was gone from the rental store. Because that's what you would do. Like, same thing happened to Tengen Tetris, you know? Like, someone kept it. So I remember at that point, I still loved it, but I didn't have it. And none of my friends had it. And there was a thing where Konami had, like, we could buy posters. And I sent in a thing. I bought a poster of the cover of Castlevania, this giant one sheet of the cover.
Nice.
And I had that on my wall, even though I didn't own the game. And I didn't buy it until they reprinted it after, like, Simon's Quest came out. So, yeah, Castlevania 1 was, like, this holy grail thing. And I would play versus Castlevania in the arcade at Aladdin's Castle as well. Around
yeah, I never saw versus Castlevania. I only ever saw it on PlayChoice once or twice.
I've never seen it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had one of those two set-up PlayChoices, and one of them was versus Castlevania at my Aladdin's Castle.
Wow.
Nice.
That's pretty cool. I'd like to see that.
That was a good castle.
But yeah, I'll never forget like hearing about Castlevania at church.
Yeah, that's pretty great. How do I defeat the Grim Reaper? Like, it's just in the middle of a church playground. I love it.
And I distinctly remember like teaching other kids how to get the triple holy water early on, and that really is the best thing for the whole game. Even though you're going to want to use the cross boomerang, the holy water is really your secret to beating both Grim Reaper and Dracula.
Yeah.
Well, it is a game about defeating evil. I think that's valid for a church playground.
I agree.
Also, it took me a long time to beat Dracula. Like, years. I think it actually took me, like, 3 or 4 years before I could beat Dracula.
Did the original Castlevania have that nonsense like you had in Castlevania 3 where they made it purposely harder so that kids who rented the game would get screwed over? Like, in Castlevania 3, you were sent back to the beginning of Dracula's level versus just being sent back to the start of him.
No. So the NES game was tuned a little differently than the Famicom Disk System game. Like, enemies basically hit for the same value of damage based on the area you're in as opposed to what the enemy
right.
is. So it's a little harder, but Castlevania is very forgiving in that not only do you start at the foot of Dracula's lair when you die, but you also start there when you continue. So
if you
lose all your lives and you have to start over, you don't have to play through all of stage 6 from, you know, the beginning of the bridge all the way to Dracula's lair again.
That stage is incredibly hard.
Yeah,
it really is.
That is, yeah, like I don't know how long it would have taken me to beat that game if not for the fact that it does at least have the mercy of putting you right at Dracula as once you get there. Like, you just keep going and all you have to do is fight him. But even then, that's really tough. And I live streamed this game, I guess probably like 2 years ago now. And it was the first time I had played through it all the way for a few years. And actually quite a few years. And I'd forgotten how hard Dracula was. And like, my stream is 1 hour long. And the first half hour is me getting to Dracula. And the second half hour is just me trying to get through that fight and beat Dracula.
The jumps, like his second form, it's like the jumps they expect you to make. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Like,
it's a little ridiculous.
It's very ridiculous.
Yeah, I actually forgot that you could use holy water to stun the damn thing and attack it while it's frozen. So it took me a while to beat him without, you know, stun locking him. So it's possible, but yeah, it sounds like all of us basically saw Castlevania of some form in action and were like, that's it. That's the game. I love it.
I must have it.
Yep. So let's talk about the mystery of its creation, the enigma of its genesis, which fortunately is no longer enigmatic anymore. Back when we recorded the NES Trilogy episode in 2013-2014, we didn't know who designed Castlevania. We didn't know who directed it. And over the past year or so, it's come out that a guy named Hitoshi Akamatsu was the director of Castlevania. Also, he was the director of Castlevania 3, The Goonies 2, and Snake's Revenge. So he was like the guy who did all these kind of, I would say, like some of the more visible sort of action-adventure games that Konami published or ultra-published on NES back in the late 80s, early 90s.
It's interesting that you made The Goonies 2 is in there, because I was going to say, like, at the time, to me, in this, you know, in that silver box era when Konami had a brand identity in much the same way that, like, Capcom did, as a kid, to me, Castlevania felt like a little less kiddie, a little more serious than, you know, Goonies 2 or Twinbee, your Stinger Twinbee, or, you know, there just wasn't as much goofiness. It was more like Gradius, you know, and to know that he did Goonies 2, which is pretty goofy comparatively, but that's interesting.
It is, but it's also harrowing, and both games involve bridges that are horrible. In Castlevania, you have a bridge where giant bats, who are the boss of the first stage, attack you, and in Goonies 2, you have skulls that will eat your boomerang and make you have to go back and find a new boomerang. So
he has something for bridges, then.
Yeah, he has a bridge aversion.
Do you think he was tasked with just, like, make a movie starring Dracula, Wolfman, and Frankenstein? I mean, just make this game? Like, just Universal Movie Monsters, make game.
You know, I haven't actually looked to see if he said where the idea came from, but I seem to remember that the film strip motif, you know, the idea of the movie kind of came in later. That wasn't, like, the basic premise of the game.
But I remember as a kid, though, the fact that it wasn't just Dracula, that it was Dracula with a bunch of other giant, you know, famous monsters, that was kind of the appeal.
Yeah, like Dracula was the boss of them all. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was like, oh, what a great idea. Like, it was before Monster Squad. It was like
Dracula has a posse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was not familiar with, you know, Universal monster movies and Hammer films and stuff, but my mother watched me beat the game once and saw the credits, quote-unquote credits, where it's like yes, all these references to horror movies like Christopher Lee and so forth. And she was like, oh, these are all jokes about characters or actors who were in these classic horror movies. And I said, oh.
Shout out to parents who, like, fill in those references. Like, it was my mom who told me where Ayla comes from in Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, yeah. Where does Ayla come from?
She's from the Clan of the Cave Bear books.
Well, there you go.
She is a book about, series about a cave woman, literally.
I didn't know that.
A lot of sex. Whole lot of caveman sex.
Yeah.
So Castlevania, you know, the credits have like Christopher B. and Boris Karloffis and so forth. So, yeah, lots of kind of a cheekiness. But that did obscure the fact that, hey, there are actually people who worked on this. Who are they? So it's only been recently that Hitoshi Akamatsu came out and said, yeah, I worked on those games. I was the director. And they weren't as successful as stuff like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So Konami shoved me into an office on the side.
Well, and Jeremy, you would know this wasn't the first Famicom action-adventure game to begin with a map screen, you know, to kind of have
That was Ghosts and Goblins.
Right. So, like, this clearly was taking a, like, the structure of it is clearly replicating Ghosts and Goblins of, like, you know, the intro, the map, the level progression.
Yeah, you started to see that a lot around this time. You know, in arcades, you had Dragon Buster. Trojan had that. It was a little later, but Dragon Buster, what else was there? Rygar. There were a lot of games that kind of showed you, like, hey, here's a map where you're progressing. But I would say that, yes, this was probably Konami's answer to Ghosts and Goblins, which was by Capcom. Mm. Capcom and Konami are not the same company, despite what the internet memes say.
No, they're rivals of the era. Like, they were, for young Shane, they were like the two third parties who you could trust to make great content.
You saw those, like, that brand packaging, the trade dress of either company, and you were like, that's it. It's going to be great. And it usually was. And
and I recall that intro scene of Simon walking up to the gates of Castlevania in the, you know, just like the clouds, the bat flying over by the clock tower. Like, it really strikes a chord in you. And it also gives you some visual storytelling of what you're about to do. And
as a kid, I just remember cinematic for the time.
Yeah, just being excited. Like, oh, it really gets you pumped.
Yeah, you know, talking about the map, I would say this game did a better job of representing your actual journey through a physical space than any other game at the time. I mean, I've, you know, recently made it through 1987 in my NES Works video series, where I'm going through the chronology of NES games released in America in the actual chronological order. And it really is startling how much Castlevania stands out compared to what had come before and what surrounded it. Like, in terms of, you know, kind of high concept design, like, here's a place that you are in, the levels represent the layout of what you see on the map, the progression map. Like, that was that was unprecedented, you know, even compared to Ghosts and Goblins. And also just the quality of the game design, the polish of the mechanics, and just how tightly everything fits together. Like, it's just so extremely well designed. And, you know, really, you look at what Konami had produced into the, to this point, and you wouldn't really expect this level of greatness. Like, yeah, the stuff they had published on NES was good, like Track and Field and Gradius and Russian Attack, but Castlevania was just a step higher in terms of quality.
I always felt like Castlevania, the Castlevania games in particular, especially 1 and 3, really showed a studio that knew exactly how to use the NES's limited color palette, especially for backgrounds.
Colors are amazing in this game.
Yeah, some of them shouldn't work, like orange blocks on cyan background. That sounds so garish, and yet somehow memorable. The use of the color palette, it seems eerie. You're like, well, you know,
it's very eerie.
It looks like, you know, the orange stones are moonlight reflecting off blocks, and then the background is, you know, cyan blue and like kind of a midnight blue, and it seems like, hey, it's the dark of night, but then the moon is shining on the stones, and it just, yeah, it works.
I feel like it's a color palette you like, they chose colors you didn't see in a lot of other games at the time too. Mm-hmm. And the combination of, like, you know, the sprite graphics themselves, how they're drawn, what's being drawn, the colors chose, it all did seem more serious, a little more adult, you know. And with the music, you know, this awesome, like, we'll get to the music more in a minute, but like this mix of synth rock and kind of orchestral prog, it's the whole package at the time to young 10, 11 year old Shane. It really was like just badass and cool in a way that even like Zelda and Metroid weren't.
He wasn't really interested in being cartoony like a lot of NES games at the time.
It kicked ass. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. Like, and like, later on there would be other games for NES that kind of went that same way with more like a harder edge, but like Castlevania was one of the first, and it got its hooks into me early.
Yeah, one of the remarkable things about the soundtrack is that the main composer was a freelancer who was like, she was a baby at the time. She was just like a college student. Kinuyo.
That's amazing.
Oh, really?
Kinuyo Yamashita. She was very, very young.
Like, how young? Like 20 something?
Like very, yeah. She was like, wow. I think just out of college maybe, or maybe even still a college student. I can't remember, but I met her at Video Games Live like 10 years ago, and I was amazed that this woman is barely older than me. Like, she's not that much older than I am. And that's really, so cool. I guess maybe like 10 years, but still, like, I didn't expect to meet the composer of Castlevania, and for her to still be like a very kind of young, vibrant person. I figured, well, it's going to be like some musty old dude, but no, it's a pretty young woman who, like, you know, could still be very active in the games industry now. I think she still does do composing and stuff. That really surprised me. I think of this as being such an old, venerable series because it was something I played as a kid. Seeing, like, meeting kind of the people who work on it and being like, oh, they're half a generation removed from me, not a full generation. That was
that's pretty cool.
That was kind of surprising.
I mean, for me, like, the audiovisual appeal was always more than half of my personal appeal to Castlevania. But the gameplay, I think, even though, as I mentioned, like, it felt a little slow and clunky, at the same time, the risk-reward element of the power-ups and the traversal, which clearly they learned a lot from Gradius, you know, of, like, oh, what it means to, like, invest in a power-up and like, the two levels of power-up, like, powering up your whip and, like, choosing the sub-weapon, and then the multiplier of the sub-weapons as well. Like, that, at that time, was enough of a complexity with the ramp of difficulty and like the no continues that the whole thing just kind of did. It worked with really well with as small as the game is too, because that's a thing too. It's not a very big game.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
And you know, I would say you described the controls as clunky. I would disagree. I would say deliberate. I would say like there's a great economy of action, and yeah, you can't control your jumps in midair and stuff, but there is a lot of precision, but there's also a pretty good amount of speed. Like this is, you know, it's not like Sonic the Hedgehog fast, but it's still a pretty fast paced game. And yes, Simon has, you know, this kind of this deliberate animation, but we're still talking about an 8-bit two-dimensional game. So there's not, you know, really downtime, and it moves at a really quick clip. And a lot of people tell me, like, constantly I hear, well, you like Castlevania, so you must like Dark Souls. But like
not quite the same
proposition
thing
of playing those two games, like the feel of them and the mobility and the kind of the investment you have to make in your character's motions and like how you really have to economize your behavior in Dark Souls, it is a different experience. And it, to me, it's like that doesn't appeal to me. I don't think less of anyone who loves it, but that's not what I want. I want a little more immediacy. And I feel like Castlevania really strikes the balance. And something I've you know, mentioned before in writing, maybe not on the podcast, is that the entire world is really designed around Simon's limits. Like every, you know, the world is basically built of these blocks, like 8x8 blocks, tiles, you know, 8-bit graphics. But the way everything works is that Simon can jump a certain height. His attack has a certain distance, which can be slightly extended with a power-up, and when you jump forward, you can jump forward a certain amount too. And they did a really good job of designing levels that work around Simon's capabilities and his limitations, and there really aren't jumps in the game that you have to be pixel perfect. It's not like you have to, you know, stand at the absolute edge of a platform, but, you know, don't go too far or you'll fall off in order to be able to make a jump. It has a little more leniency than that. So it does a good job of, like, you know, making you think about how you're moving, how you're traversing, how enemies are behaving around you, but not going so far that it's really frustrating. And it's kind of hard for me to look at this game objectively because it has been a part of my life for more than 30 years and I've played it so many times.
Well, I'm curious how Nadia, how she feels about the controls. Cause like we grew up with it and all the, you know, all the things we always wanted, like, oh man, if only I wouldn't get stuck on the stairs. And if only I could swing my whip a little faster. Like for someone who had ever played a modern Castlevania, to go back to this one, like, did you feel it was really stifling the controls, Nadia? Or like,
no.
She said she started on the NES, so she played Castlevania 2 and 3.
Yeah, I started on the NES. I started on Castlevania 3, which I finished somehow, God knows
but
how.
But even Castlevania 3, even though you still can't jump off the stairs, it's still like, like as much as Trevor still feels kind of like Simon, then you could play as Grant, which feels like twice as agile of a game.
But I never play as Grant when
it's because he sucks in the American version.
That's exactly. Like, they really nerfed him.
But he has a lot of agility. And like, I remember at the time, back in the day of Castlevania, I'd be like, oh man, if only I could swing my whip a little bit faster. You know, just because that investment in
swinging
your attack.
It feels
like
there's a certain, I think Parrish said it right when he said, like, there's a certain, like, purpose to it. Like, there, it's the way it's supposed to be. And I just kind of fall into Simon's patterns and his weight. And
well, there's a gravity to him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and one thing that I think really works in the favor of the game is that the hitbox on Simon's whip is very generous. Like, if you swing your whip forward, like, you don't have to hit something precisely on the pixel dig to get it. Like, if it kind of falls within the box of your whip, like, moving forward, like, ahead of Simon, it's going to take damage. And not only that, but when you, I think in this game, if you hit something when you swing back your whip, it'll also take damage. Maybe that's
it does. There's a I think it is this one, but it's a very tiny little spot. And then, like,
yeah, it's like one or two frames, but still
the combination of your whip and all the different sub weapons. If you know, if you think about how and where they attack, it does kind of mitigate all of his limitations strategically too. You know,
yeah, and you know, you just need to play the MSX variant of this game, which we'll talk about in a little bit, to understand how good the NES Castlevania is. Because all the things that they got right in here, they kind of did wrong on MSX. And that includes the hitbox on the whip. Like, you have to hit something pixel perfect to inflict damage on it. There is no leniency in that.
Yuck.
And it is really hard. Like, you know, all the rhythms and patterns that I'm used to, even though Simon controls the same on MSX, his attacks are different, and it's very, very frustrating if you expect the game to play like the NES game and to kind of to give you the little bit of grace that the NES game does. It does not do that. It's very challenging.
I will say NES Castlevania in America, even as a kid, like, it is balanced in such a way to where if you learn that, oh yes, double, triple boomerangs or holy water makes the game pretty easy, actually, right? Like, it isn't hard to get through most of the game if you have a fairly good build of weapons.
As long as you don't screw up and get another weapon.
Yeah, right. Well, and also, you know, the kind of thing to balance that out is the fact that if you die, you lose those things and you have to start over. So you have to be careful about not dying. True. And Simon is pretty fragile. He can only take, you know, by the end of the game, after three hits, your next hit's going to kill you unless you can find wall meat. And so, you know, the damage that he takes carries over from one level to the next. You only get a refill once you beat a boss. So yes, it's one thing to say, oh, you just need to hold on to the triple holy water through the whole game. But actually doing that is very challenging, especially your first time through, because you are going to come up against enemies that move in ways you don't expect. Like, you get to stage five and all of a sudden you've got, you know, the little fleamen, the hunchbacks jumping around.
Oh, God.
And they're so unpredictable. Yes. You've got, you know, the axe armors that they actually kind of hover back out of range of holy water, so you can't count on that to take them out.
And they're really fast. They're pretty fast, too, the axe armors. Yeah.
The axe armors throw axes at two heights, high and low. They have a shield to block, like, standard throwing weapons. And while they're doing that, you know, later in the game, or later in the stage, they're being accompanied by those damn flying Medusas that move in the sine wave pattern. So you have to keep track of a lot of things. So yeah, it's one thing to say, like, oh, you just need to hold on to the holy water. It's another thing to actually hold on to the holy water.
Yeah. And it's funny you bring up the first time we brought up the flying Medusa heads. Like, I remember at that time, them being, like, iconic, horrible enemy that I thought were really cool and really evil and always bothered me. And, like, yeah, it's almost like a trope now of, like, that type of enemy. Like,
yeah,
but,
definitely.
You know, what a brilliant concept for a side scroller, you know, an enemy like that.
What was the origin of the Medusa heads, like, in terms of horror? Was it, like, from
I mean, I would imagine what was the movie from the 80s? Clash of the Titans was probably huge.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
I
mean, the myth of Medusa is that Perseus cut her head off. So,
like, nothing to do with Dracula.
No, not at all. Or, it definitely is, you know, like a kind of one of those Hammer films, or I guess in this case a Harryhausen film, but they were cribbing from, you know, from the mythology. Right. But
then, like, I think about also, like, just the boss encounters, even the first one, like, you walk in and you see the bat waiting for you, right? Or, like, the Medusa,
kind of
you see the friendly Medusa head waiting on the table for you before you approach it, you know?
Well, I think, like, she starts out as a statue and then she unstones herself.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, just like that, much like the beginning of the game, these little touches, these little, you know, extra elements to add, like, storytelling to the game.
Yeah, and there's lots of areas in the game where you get a unique background, even though they were dealing with a cartridge with extremely limited space, storage space. You still get, like, a special stained glass room for Medusa, or
the crypt for the mummies.
The crypt for the mummies, or the tower in the background when you're approaching the mummies.
Yeah.
Or, like, in, you know, in the last stage, you see, you know, before you get to the very end, you see the clock tower in the background, the one part. And, like,
no, that's stage three. You see the clock tower when you're, like, halfway there.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And
of course, you have the moon before you encounter Dracula, which is kind of iconic now. It's hard to have a Castlevania game without it.
Yeah, and you even above the kind of the exit from the clock tower where you're climbing up to Dracula's lair, they took the time to create, you know, an actual clock that you can barely even see. It's way up there, but they made a lot of smart choices and said, let's kind of splurge on some embellishments just to enhance this game, even though we're dealing with limited cartridge space. And it really works in the game's favor. It just creates this evocative place. And we were talking about the colors earlier. It's funny because, you know, I'm always trying to, like, record and stream from classic hardware. And it's really hard to get the colors in some of the stages right. Like, stage two, on some hardware and with some color palettes, it shows up as brown. But on others, it shows up as, like, a deep purple.
Wow.
And I don't know which one is right. So I just kind of like, well, I'll just, you know, go with whatever the system spits out at me. But, you know, even with those kind of quirks and limitations of the NES where there's no fixed color palette, they still manage to create a game that just looks great no matter how you see it.
Well, also the clock tower as another trope, as another, or at the time, like, you know, I'd heard about it before I ever saw it because it's pretty deep in the game. And it just sounds like a cool concept.
Well, it's on the back of the box.
It is. But then when you finally get there, see all the animation, hear the music, and it's hard, and it's, you know, it's very memorable, and it's, I remember thinking, this is so cool. And like, still to this day, I think Clock Tower stages are cool. Like, 30, you know, for 30 years later, for, you know, how much later? All these years later. Like,
yeah, me too.
Like, yeah, what a brilliant concept. Like, just like, they really, it's amazing what they came up with in this game, and like how many smart ideas they hit on.
For and how many became staples for later games, like the Clock Tower and Symphony of the Night is iconic.
Right.
So basically, NES Castlevania or Famicom Disk System Castlevania, which I guess technically came first, same game, a little bit of a different balance, no save files in the NES version, but basically they just got it right. It's a remarkable piece of work where they, you know, this team who hadn't, that I am aware of, created any games together before from a company that was still kind of defining itself, basically just got it right. And again, to really appreciate how well they did with the NES Castlevania, how right they got it, you just need to look at the other version that came out at the same time, like a month later in Japan, Vampire Killer or Akumajo Dracula for the MSX2 home computer, which is basically this game, except it's just, it doesn't work as well. It's really frustrating and like, it's intriguing and interesting and I like to play it, but it's also really frustrating.
When I look at it in a YouTube video, because I haven't played it myself, it seems like a very interesting concept. You're looking at Castlevania, which with much more of an adventure feel like you would get in later games down the line.
It's so strange. And like, Jeremy, I think, did we work together when I first got it? It would have been about 2010 when I was working at 1UP. I bought an MSX2. And nice. This is one of the games I really wanted for it. And
I actually don't remember that.
Yeah. So yeah, I have like a Sony MSX2. It was black and I was pretty disappointed in this game because it's like it's kind of inscrutable at first, and then like, you know, if you read up on like what am I supposed to be doing in this game, it's like, wow, it's very complicated, it's very difficult, and like it just everything feels a little off, and like, but at the same time it's impressive, and it just how did this happen, and it almost felt like it was trapped in time and like kept away from us for reasons like, oh, like it doesn't quite work, it's like, yeah, it's very, very strange, and I found myself
it was released in Europe. It's just that America didn't really have the MSX, so there was just no market for it here. But, you know, the reason this happened, as you say, is because it was designed by someone else. It was not designed by Hitoshi Akamatsu. It was designed by Akihiko Nagata, who would go on to be the producer on Snatcher and Police Knots and Metal Gear Solid.
Oh, really?
Oh, well, it's much more kind of an adventure game.
Yeah.
Like almost like a PC adventure game.
Yes, that is exactly what this is. So this takes the overall structure of Castlevania, the 18 stages divided into 6 levels, and you get like the same beats. You get a lot of the same graphical assets. Like the levels look the same from one stage, you know, from one system to the other. And you fight the same bosses, you have the same hero who has many of the same capabilities, but then everything is just off.
It's the Shelbyville of Castlevania.
But MSX, which means no scrolling. Like, oh, you thought you were going to scroll? You thought you were going to scroll? It was screen by screen.
Right, but they make the most of that by introducing this kind of infinite scrolling on, or infinite looping in some areas. Yeah. Some stages, if you keep going to the right, you'll hit the end of the stage, and then you'll just wrap around back to the first screen. Some stages, it's vertical, and if you drop down, you'll like come in at the top of the stage. So they kind of play with that and force you to sort of explore space. But basically, your goal in each of the 18 stages is to find the white key that leads you to the next level. It opens the door and takes you to the next level. That's really all you're doing.
Like, tragically, you know what it reminded me of? Like, after all those years of, like, dreaming what this game is going to be, it reminded me of all things, Ghost House, my card for Sega Master System, which is
it's not that bad.
I mean, but it's not Castlevania. And, like, you know, when you're like, oh, this, like, fantasy alternate thing that you've been dreaming of for 20 years, and you finally play it, and you're like, yikes, not what I thought it was going to be.
I mean, I think it almost works. Like, the fundamental idea of basically turning each individual stage into this kind of self-contained labyrinth that you have to, you know, explore and find items and things. You have to find keys to open chests that'll give you temporary upgrades. Like, that's fundamentally sound. The problem is it's just not as well put together as the NES game. I mentioned the hitboxes, but also things like the enemies, the Medusas, you know, the sine waves that they move in, they have a higher wavelength than on NES. So it's harder to hit them.
Well, and things look a little different in an interesting way sometimes. Like, some of the graphics are reused, but other ones do look different to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were some limitations. But, you know, things like bats will constantly respawn, but they move faster on MSX, and they respawn more quickly. So it makes, you know, any screen where you have spawning bats or spawning Medusa heads, they're way harder.
That sucks.
Enemies take a lot more hits to destroy. Like, you can't kill a skeleton with just one or two hits. You have to hit it like six times.
And that's stupid.
Yeah, it's just like lots of little minor.
That sounds like a lot of little annoyances piled into one spot.
Yes, that's exactly the problem with the MSX game. Is it just does lots of little things that you're like, no, don't do that. But then you add up all those little things, and it's a whole lot of like, don't do that.
One big don't.
Did you
do that.
See it through to the end? Because I think I bailed like halfway through.
I haven't done that yet. The game is really hard because it gives you three lives and no continues.
Yeah.
So realistically, the only way to finish this game is to buy a special cheat device that Konami sold called the Game Master. And I tracked one of these down. They're really hard to find. It took me a while to find one. And I finally had to import it from the UK, which fortunately I did before like international mail got shut down because of the pandemic.
So you can now cheat.
The Cheat Master, what it will let you do with Castlevania, because the MSX computer has two cartridge ports. So you plug in Castlevania's cartridge in one port and then the Cheat Master in the other. And at the title screen, it will say, like, what stage do you want to start on and how many lives do you want? And that's it. So basically, you can give yourself 99 lives. You can start on any stage you want, which is good because there is a part in, like, stage 5, this part with Medusas and moving platforms that is the definition of bullshit. It is one of the hardest things I have ever done in a video game.
Retro bullshit.
And miraculously, I streamed this game and I got past it on my first try through sheer stupid luck. But when I was playing for myself and trying to record my progress, I spent like 10 or 15 minutes trying to get past it and finally just said, I've got to jump to the next level. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's full of things like that.
Does the cheat device work on all MSX games, all Konami MSX games, or literally just this game?
It works on any Konami game released before this, I believe. And then they released, a couple of years later, they released the Game Master 2, which will let you cheat on some other games.
That's amazing.
But yes, basically, I think they knew. Like, the Game Master actually came out before Castlevania in Japan. But they left hooks for the Game Master in Castlevania. And there is actually a page, the back page of the manual, like tells you, hey, go buy a Cheat Master. Here's what it is. Like, they designed this game to sell a peripheral. Like, that is literally what they did. They are like,
wow, that's amazing.
Go spend 4,000 yen and buy a peripheral so that you can get past stage 3 of this game.
Hey, yeah, this game sucks. Go buy something else.
Correct me if I'm wrong. This never made it anywhere except for maybe WiiWare MSX or like Virtual Console MSX? Right?
Yeah, it made it to the MSX Virtual Console in Japan only, not even in Europe. And that's it. That's the only time it's been republished.
Because like Solid Snake, you know, got ported to PS3, but like, yeah, this is kind of stuck.
Yep.
Maybe for the best.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's something here. And if you went in and did a ROM hack where you just changed some of the values of like Simon's hitbox, gave people continues, made enemies a little less durable, made enemy patterns a little less frustrating, I think it would be really fun. It's really a game that shows the difference between a good idea with poor execution and a game with a good idea and great execution. And that's the difference between MSX and NES.
Have you ever encountered a super fan of this game? Do they exist?
I know that some fans do exist. I actually had them comment on my stream, like telling me how much I sucked. Because they were just kids and they beat it easily. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Of course. I mean, come on, Parrish, get with the times here.
Yeah, right?
I just think that the guy who made this at the time must have felt like shit. He's like, oh man, look what I made compared to this really good game over on Famicom.
But I mean, it does try to be something different. It is not attempting to reproduce that experience. And that really comes into focus when you get to the hallway that leads up to Frankenstein's monster. Because on NES, that is literally just a hallway. You walk, you fight two of those dragon skeleton things, and then you fight Dracula's monster. But on MSX... you know, there's like these arches in the background that in the MSX version, those arches are actually active doors. And I kind of stumbled onto that by mistake because it's just a loop. You like just keep looping back to the beginning unless you squat in front of one of those archways. And then that takes you into like the back layer of the stage, kind of like the Goonies 2, actually.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And that's weird. So it becomes this really big, complex labyrinth. And there's a lot of interesting stuff that you can acquire. Like in addition to, you know, the keys that you pick up, you can get these semi-permanent upgrades that will last until you reach the next stage. And they'll increase your jump, your movement speed.
I do remember that. There's like, some light RPG.
You can increase your durability. You can increase your whip strength. And you can also, like, the whip is not the only weapon you can use. There are only two sub-weapons, the clock and the holy water, but Simon can get an axe and he can get a dagger, and those replace his sword, or his whip, sorry.
His whip.
And so you basically have infinite daggers that you can throw, or an axe that flies like a boomerang, like the Axe Knights. But the thing about the axe is that if you don't catch it when it comes back to you, it flies off screen and you have to go back to your whip. Yeah, and also, you know, sometimes if you like, this game is really big on hidden objects in the walls. Like you have the wall meat in Castlevania on NES, but that's pretty much it.
Well, no,
whereas
you're wrong.
Here, like you're constantly smashing up walls, but when you break a wall with the axe falls on the ground and you have to go over and pick it up. It's just so many weird ideas.
Well, you bring up all that stuff does remind me, oh yeah, all those like little power ups and the throwing and you know, it's that RPG stuff. It's interesting that it's so early in this Castlevania and that would get picked up in other ones down the line. But like, you're wrong that the NES Castlevania doesn't have as many hidden secrets. Right in the walls, there aren't as many hidden secrets. But there's lots of like, if you stand in this place, if you kneel in this place,
sure,
this treasure will rise
but
up.
There are not as many of those in NES Castlevania as there are walls that you have to break here. Like you get to the bridge leading to the mummies, and you literally have to break your way through just walls that are blocking the bridge.
You are right, but there is a lot more of that in the NES Castlevania than like back in, like there's more of those than you think you might have found back in the day, of those hidden chests and bags.
Oh no, I know where they all are, but those are just bonus points. Whereas in MSX Castlevania, those hidden walls are all over the place, and you have to sometimes break them in the right order in order to get keys that will take you to the next stage. Like there is just so many places where you have to hit walls and kind of unintuitive places.
Somebody
too.
Really hated walls.
Yes. There's a real like microaggression going against walls here. Anyway, it's an interesting game, and I would like to see it brought back, you know, revisited, but with a little bit of refinement. Like if M2 were to port this to something and then be like, okay, here's the original, like the perfect emulation of Castlevania for MSX. And also, here's the M2 version where we take out the bullshit, and it's actually kind of fun.
I wish they could have taken like all the best parts of this game, Vampire Killer, and like all the best parts of like Haunted Castle, and get rid of all the bad parts of both those two games and make one good game out of those two games or something.
Shane, there are no good parts in Haunted Castle.
Yeah, at the beginning, the tuxedo.
All right, let's talk about Haunted Castle now. So that was the arcade game, came out in 1988 February, so a year and a half after the Famicom Disk System and MSX games that we've just talked about. And it's not called Castlevania, it's called Haunted Castle in the US for some stupid reason, but it's Castlevania. And it's not fun.
Did you encounter it in the arcade? I did.
I never saw this game, I never touched this game until it came out for PS2 in Japan on the Oratachi Game Center series.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was at 1UP.
I was with you. I also bought that hamster disc for secondly with a little 3-inch CD.
I remember playing this with a bunch of people, and we were all like, wow, this game is actually really bad and annoying.
I watched videos of it, and it just looks like a bunch of arcade bullshit.
I mean, I knew it was bad from being a kid, and like, remember, I liked Castlevania, and then I saw this, and it wasn't called Castlevania, and had ostensibly good big graphics, you know, like,
yeah, they did look good.
Like, well, like, good is weird, because I remember at the time, like, oh, they're big, mm-hmm. but kind of silly, and also this game's impossible, and it's like Castlevania, but like heavy metal Castlevania, but real bad.
it's got some real amateurishness to the graphics. It's like Simon moves really poorly.
Yeah, he moves really, he's got a really weird Belmont strut going on in this one.
It's a weird one.
It's like he's holding his arm that he's like injured permanently. It's very strange. Like, oh no, my chest, what is going on?
Well, so this wasn't made simultaneously, so you think they could have looked at what the other people had done more, right? No? Like,
yeah, this came out actually after Castlevania 2 on NES or Famicom Disk System.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, after it came out in Japan. So it does have some of the music from Castlevania 2, which is good. That's the best part of Haunted Castle, is that, oh, you've got Bloody Tears. Nice.
Yeah, Bloody Tears is always welcome.
It must have been for a new arcade board, right? Compared to what they were on previously. They're like, oh, look, this thing can make larger sprites. We should make, like, that must have been the order of business. Like, make the sprites larger than what we were doing before. And that didn't make it better to me.
Yeah, we talked about this in our Castlevania Oddballs episode last year. So I don't want to linger on it too long.
But I will defend this like a little bit, because there's things I like about this game, like the music. I like the intro. I like some of the graphics in it, but it's pretty much unplayable. Like,
I like the parts where it does things you don't expect, like when
like kill you.
Well, yeah. There's that.
Well, I mean, you expect that from Castlevania.
No, but there's like weird things that just pop up and like things that fall on your head and shit in this game.
Creature of chaos.
Yeah, but then there's the part that we like. I always come back to where all of a sudden you're like thrust into another universe and harpies attack you, and then without warning you're back in your normal universe. It's like
right.
What just happened? What the hell?
I mean, to me, it just feels like at some point someone should have given them notes like, yeah, this isn't quite as playable. Like it just felt like they went for graphics and like spectacle. There's like set pieces that aren't fun.
Oh, it's an arcade game. So they didn't want it to be playable or fair. They wanted it to suck your quarters out.
They wanted your quarters.
Yeah.
But it's not one of those games where you're like, oh, this game is really tough, but I know I can beat it because it's so cool. It's just one of those where you're like, whoa, this game is really hard and it's a worse version of Castlevania.
It almost reminds me of Rostan 2, and that's not a compliment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of going for that Rostan Saga sort of thing, which is not good. So the giant Simon thing, we haven't mentioned him by name. Simon Belmont, the vampire hunter, he's the hero. The giant Simon Belmont thing wouldn't really work out until Super Castlevania 4, which is very much a game built around like, hey, let's make Simon's sprite really big and make it move awkwardly, and let's make that cool.
Yeah. Although when I played the game myself, Castlevania 4, my brother was like, "Why does Simon have an orgasm every time he falls down a cliff?" So I can't hear that.
That's not the sound that I hear, but okay. That's not how I interpret it. But I guess we all have different responses to those situations.
Absolutely, especially when we're stupid little punk kids playing a game.
But Super Castlevania IV was directed by someone named Masahiro Ueno, who produced a lot of sports games, was the programmer on Metal Gear and Base Wars for NES, and later went on to work as quote-unquote franchise director on Contra and Time Pilot, but in a period where they weren't making those games. So I don't know about that one.
All those new Time Pilots for mobile, you know.
Yeah, right? But this was before that. So it's like a weird kind of in-between space, a liminal space. The producer on it was Kazumi Kitawe, who was the producer on a ton of stuff, like everything Konami did in the 90s, and eventually ascended to business development heaven. So he just shows up as, like, business.
Oh, yeah. I interviewed him back in the day when I was at EGM.
Oh, yeah? Guy. Let's hear about him.
I just remember he was old and friendly.
Oh.
Yeah, that's nice.
I like friendly old men.
That's all you can really hope for.
Had I known he worked on this, I would have geeked out on him like I did the guy who made Rondo of Blood. Like when I was in Japan years ago doing like, you know, Lament of Innocence cover story, I had brought my Rondo of Blood and like begged Iga to take me to the dude who directed Rondo of Blood, who was like a director, and like took me and like I had him autograph my Rondo of Blood. Yeah, he was like 70 years old.
Yeah, I fangirled over Igarashi when I got to interview him at PAX. Everyone gets
this
one.
This game rocked my world because I was such a Sega fanboy that I was not going to buy a Super Nintendo on day one. I was like so Sega Genesis. I was like, I'm going to wait. I don't need this. And then as soon as I played Super Castlevania 4 and ActRaiser and Super Mario World and F-Zero, I was like, fuck, I have to buy this.
You were like SpongeBob in that meme. I need it.
But it really was Super Castlevania 4 of all of them, of the entire launch lineup, that was like, oh my fucking God, it's everything I've ever wanted. And this was my favorite Castlevania until I later played Symphony of the Night. And then like in post, I think Rondo of Blood is actually just as good, if not better than this. But at the time, I loved this game so much. And I used to play through
it. Definitely one of my favorites.
I used to play through it every year for like 20 years.
I still play, like whenever I boot up my SNES Classic, I always go straight to Castlevania 4, yeah. Sort of a warm up and just play that opening stage with hear the theme of Simon and see the like the fence rise out of the ground. That's still so freaking metal.
I used to just like let the music play as a kid. I was like boot it up and like let the music play on stages.
Oh,
like,
I used to do that. My mom would get pissed off.
It's I loved everything about it. And I loved that it was Castlevania but blown out to like 20 times the scale as
right
well.
That's the important thing to discuss, because we're including it here in this episode. Even though the name is Super Castlevania 4, that's not really what this game is. Yes, it was the fourth release chronologically on a Nintendo console, but this is the original Castlevania. It is Simon Belmont's
Akuma
quest
Dracula.
Into the castle to fight Dracula. And yes, in Japan it is just called Akumajo Dracula, which is the same thing that the NES and the MSX games were called.
Yes, I was very confused by that for the longest time when I first came on the internet, and people of course were like, you know, what abouting you, and like, you know, giving you little bits of trivia when you'd ask for it. That was one thing, like, oh, it's actually the original Castlevania's remake, and I'm like, get out of town, there's no way. But no, it's the original.
I also remember when the first screenshots came out of this, I remember thinking it didn't look good, and then like it's kind of because the way the graphics are drawn don't translate well to like bad screenshots. Like,
yeah,
those first screenshots looked weird and pixely, but in motion this game looks so much better than just a screenshot
and
done.
So much mode 7 trickery, holy crap.
Yeah, everywhere. Yeah,
I have to admit this game, I went back to it to really spend some time with it last year for Super NES Works videos, and I really expected to just be like, this is going to be so awesome and amazing. And I didn't really like it that much. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I remember you were a little bit down on it, as I recall.
It's good, but I feel like if you compare it to the original Castlevania, yes, there's more game here, it's bigger, but I don't feel it's as thoughtful in terms of like how the world works in relationship to Simon.
There's too much.
It's not that there's too much, but... You know, they gave Simon the ability to do a lot more with his whip. In Castlevania, you can whip forward. That's it. You can jump and whip, or you can stand and whip. Here, you can whip in what, five directions, forward, backward,
you can
up.
You can flagellate your whip.
And you can, yeah, you can even jump and then whip down while you're coming
or,
down.
Or make it go limp and just slowly flagellate creatures in front of you.
You can do all these things with your whip, but because Simon is so big and he can do, like, his sprite on screen proportionally is really big, and then you have a whip that you can aim in many, many directions, you can basically cover the entire screen with your whip. So at that point,
awesome.
You're like, it's great, but then you pick up sub-weapons and you don't ever need to use them. Why would you use sub-weapons when you can just use your whip? Because, you know...
I did use Holy Water quite...
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
Holy Water does have the persistence, which is valuable, but, you know, like the axe.
Useless, dagger,
in Castlevania, the axe is incredibly valuable because... You know, the axe gives you an upward arc for your attack, which you don't normally have. But here, you just aim up at an angle, and you've hit something faster and more efficiently than with an axe.
All of your criticisms are completely valid. And in fact, like, you know, I was playing this again on PS4 when it came out last year in whatever the collection was, and there is something unique about this game in that, like, yes, you're huge, you're always kind of in the center of the screen, and yes, you can always hit every part of the level with your whip, and it's kind of easy. But all that, the presentation of the world and the idea,
it's so great.
And the ideas and the music, it all, like, it's more than the sum of its parts, but you're right, on a gameplay specific level, it has very much gotten away from, the economy of design that made the first game what it was.
I just love the visual storytelling you have where you are actually on Dracula's estate.
Right.
And you have, like, you start with the stables and you go on to, like, the aqueducts,
like,
and
I love that map, which is like little, you know, it's like this little diorama almost. It's beautiful.
It's so cute. I love it. Oh my gosh, yeah. I want one for my room.
Yeah, this really is a game about spectacle. It is a game about, like, every level is unique and has some kind of gimmick to it. I mean, the fourth stage is the one that everyone remembers because it's got the Mode 7 trickery. But it's just like, you know, even before you get there,
you have
falling rocks, you have waterfalls.
There's levels you forget about, like the treasury, brilliant. Yep. Or this
treasury. There's a lot of silliness to this game, too. Like, the treasury, you've got, like, these very goofy-looking ghosts flying out of the ground, just like...
It's Casper. He's saying hi.
Yeah, it's very silly. Like, this game doesn't take itself as seriously. Like, it's got a real kind of comical goofiness to it that...
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting take on Castlevania. Because it's... on one hand, you've got the music, which is sublime.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Great. And then you've got, you know, like, the treasury ghosts who are like, ooh, we're so scary.
Halloween.
I mean, thinking back on it, it's so far expanded from the structure of just being Castlevania that the remake aspect of Castlevania gets lost a bit. And, like, you know, here and there you remember, oh, yeah, like, this is kind of like that level. But in post, when I think back to Super Castlevania 4, I don't think about those elements really. I mean, the clock tower is great, but really it's more like all those weird cool elements that were added just for this game. So
I really don't think of it as a remake, to be honest with you.
Right.
To this day.
So almost as a remake, it doesn't quite work all these years later.
Yeah, fair enough. It's more like a do-over, more of a reboot than a remake.
Right. When I think about this fight against Death, which is one of my favorites, like, you know,
I love the Room of Close Associates. That's so awesome.
Right, uh-huh. But then at the same time, I remember the death in, you know, in Rondo Blood on the ship. That's almost actually better, you know. And it's like, oh well, like, you know, this isn't the end all be all Castlevania version. It just at the time was what I needed, what I wanted, and like the depth of it. It actually is a little bit more of a Metroidvania than you kind of remember it being, in that there are like some hidden paths and little different ways to go.
That's not Metroidvania.
No, but like the easiness of it too, like. And, like, the way you progress through the levels kind of opened it up more to, like, be less of an old-school Castlevania, more of a leisurely jaunt through a long game.
There's that hidden area with the man and the dog, and it makes me sad to think about
it. The man and the dog is the best part of that fucking game. He cries. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, it's so sad. What is the deal with that dog and
man?
Oh,
I love it.
Yeah, I get comments on that YouTube video still where people are like, this game's not too easy. This is like super hard. You know, Rondo of Blood is way easier than this.
What? Hell no.
Are you stoned?
Rondo of Blood kicks my ass.
Super Castlevania 4 is super easy.
Yeah.
It really is. And like, I've never, even though I love Castlevania games, I'm really not great at the classic ones. But Super Castlevania 4 is pretty easy to jog through.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's still fun, though. I really enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. It's great fun.
You know what's funny? I kind of want a remake of Super Castlevania 4.
A remake of a remake? Is that legal?
I think so.
Remake squared.
Yeah, I said this was like a reboot, but it really wasn't because it's it. That's it. There's no more. There are no other Castlevania games like Super Castlevania 4. It was like an experiment. That is, yeah, it stands as a singular achievement in the series. Cool. And at no point did they ever say, let's do another one of those.
I mean, both that, I'll say that game and Castlevania 64 are like so like bespoke to their hardware. It's like, yeah, those are of a time.
Well, I mean, at least Castlevania 64 had a Legacy of Darkness. Wasn't that what it was called?
The fixed, slightly fixed version.
Yeah, it's like a werewolf sequel, but also a remake or like repackaging. Yes. It was weird.
I never played the 64 games.
You're not missing out.
So I hear.
Yeah, as much as, you know, Castlevania 64 was actually just called Castlevania, and probably, you know, with that title should have been a remake, but it wasn't. It was a different character. And I think in Japan it was called, like, Dracula Apocalypse or something.
Yes.
So, so clearly not, like, the branding really gets muddled there, but it was not a 3D take on the original Castlevania. It was Reinhard Schneider killing skeletons.
Schneider. Skeletons on motorcycles.
Yeah, skeletons on motorcycles. And I think Frankenstein's monster chased him around with a chainsaw through a hedge maze. There was some wild stuff in that game.
That's pretty cool.
It was not a good game, but it was crammed full of ideas.
I would describe its graphics as unlookable.
You will turn to stone. Do not look.
Do not look.
All right, so we've talked about everything except the true remake of Castlevania.
Okay, which I stand so hard for this game. Like, come
Don't
at me.
Stand.
I love it. I love the remake of his hair. I love the soundtrack. Oh, chef's
Are you talking about the Castlevania version or the PlayStation version?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we were originally going to just talk about Akumajo Dracula for X68000, but I guess we can include
that version. You can play that version with its original soundtrack. That's where I first played it, was on that PlayStation version. So,
right, yes, the PlayStation remake of the X86000 remake of Castlevania Chronicles.
Right. That Sharp computer never came out here. Did that come out in Europe? That computer, or is it just?
I don't believe it did. I think it was Japan only. And it's a shame because it's a hell of a beast. It is. It is basically the equivalent of a Capcom CPS-1 board, to the point that you can get basically arcade-perfect conversions of Capcom arcade games like Strider and Final Fight on X68000 because it's the same hardware. So it's like people complain about, is Final Fight for Super NES or Final Fight CD better? No, the answer is Final Fight for X68000, friend. But
is it because the resolution? Is it because the resolution was perfect for it? There's something about the way it looks. It like just looks.
No, it's
cleaner.
The same. It's the same processor. It's literally
the same
68000 Motorola processor. Like,
which was also in the Genesis, right?
It was, and the Amiga. But this was like a much closer to match to, you know, in terms of RAM and everything, to what Capcom created their games on.
Also, this computer had like three different sound cards, right? So you have there were different versions of the audio often. Am I wrong?
Yeah, there was like a MIDI card, and there was like the Sound Blaster equivalent, and the basic built-in hardware, I think an FM synthesis module.
Right.
It was nuts. Yeah, like there's a version of Bosconian that I know we've talked about on the show before, that it's Bosconian, but it has this absolutely scorching Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack to it. It's crazy.
Nice.
Like, why is this amazing music in here? What is happening?
You own the unique nemesis for this thing, don't you? Is it you? Do you own that?
No, I don't.
If you buy that, I'm coming to your house after the coronavirus, after the quarantine.
Just move out here. It's great. It'll be good for you.
I'll say that is my holy grail right now, is that Nemesis for the 68,000.
Really? I'm still trying to get my X68000 up and working. I haven't had a chance to really mess with it, but I think maybe over the 4th of July holiday, since it's not like we're going anywhere, I might devote some time to that.
So had you emulated this before it came out for PlayStation?
No, I hadn't. X68000 emulators were not all that common at the time. Right. So when this came out for PlayStation in 2000.
Yeah. So it came out in its original version and a remake. And I remember when I imported it for like $60, you know, because it came out in Japan first. I played the original version first because I wanted to have that experience, and I loved it, but it was hard as hell. It's hard.
It's really hard. This is Castlevania. Like, it is very faithful to the original Castlevania. It adds more levels. But, you know, in terms of your skills and just, you know, the way the world reacts around you, it feels very much like Castlevania. But this is Castlevania that knows that you've played Castlevania. It's kind of like that Final Fantasy IV remake for DS.
I was going to say Final Fantasy IV for the DS, with the one that screws with you.
Yeah, these people know all the tricks. So we are going to blow their minds by just totally changing everything. And that really comes into focus when you get into the second section and you go down, you get ready to go down into the water passageway with the fishmen, and you stop there and you're like, oh, I'm going to hit the wall and get some meat. And when you hit the wall, meat does not come out. Instead, an infinite stream of fleemen come out of this wall, and they're just hopping all over, and they will kill you because there's way more fleemen than you can possibly hope to manage. And also, I'm just going to take a break here and get some meat. No, you're getting a face full of
you're
death.
Getting fleemen.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you love Castlevania. You just spent all this time on this game. You're going to die all the time. It's so hard. It's so good. But the music is the best, too. Like, any of the versions of the soundtrack, so good.
Yeah, last year they had this set up at Long Island Retro Expo, which sadly won't be taking place this year. But there's a guy who every year brings his X68000 computer with like the Roland speakers and the advanced sound card.
Oh, beautiful.
It's just like, it is magnificent. And he had this set up and I got to play it on his X68000. And it was just a reminder that, man, this game is so good. Of course, Kurt Collada of Hardcore Gaming 101, also the guy who created the Castlevania dungeon, the definitive Castlevania site in the days before like Wikia. Like, he was there and he sat down and he just like blasted through the game. And I was like, well, yes, of course, the Castlevania dungeon guy is going to be really good at Castlevania. But watching him play was like, I'm envious because I do not play that game this well. But yeah, it's so full of fun ideas. And even though it is basically a kind of a retelling of Castlevania, they add so much stuff in. There's like a stage where you're riding a raft down a river and you have to, you know, it's an auto scrolling stage sort of, which normally sucks, but it's challenging and interesting. There's a stage where, for no reason whatsoever, a stained glass window explodes and the pieces turn into a knight that fights you, and you have to fight this like stained glass knight that's floating around in air and has all these sharp edges. It's so cool. They, you know, before Symphony of the Night, they had the fountain in here, like the Fountain of Blood. Mm-hmm. It's so full of great ideas, and it looks good. Like, it's big, chunky Simon, kind of like from Haunted Castle, but instead of being completely ugly and like make you vomit, it looks really good. And everything moves with grace. There's a lot of detail, but it does have that kind of considered design of the original Castlevania where, you know, everything kind of makes sense in relation to Simon. And you don't feel like, oh, you know, they're really screwing me over here. They're giving me more than I can handle. They're making me do perfect pixel perfect jumps. There's none of that. It's very thoughtfully composed. It's very, very hard, but at no point do you ever come away from this game thinking, man, this is BS. This is garbage.
Yeah, it kind of just feels like the best version of like the classic Castlevania formula. It really is good. I love it.
It's been a long time since I played it, but I remember enjoying it.
Yeah, all this talk about it makes me want to dig it out. I think it's
same.
I think you can also download it as a PS1 game and play it on your PS3 or Vita.
And that's what I use my Vita for these days. My Vita is my PS1 RPG machine.
And if you think the 68,000 sprite of Simon Belmont looks beautiful, just wait until you see what they've done to him on the PlayStation 1, because he is fierce.
Yeah, he is the raver Simon. He is Simon who went out clubbing like, in Tokyo like, in 2000.
Well, he went clubbing with Ayami Kojima and came back looking fierce. It's awesome.
Yeah, he's got...
Is that the one where he has the red hair?
He's got red hair. Yes. He's wearing like leather, black leather.
Like,
and
a leather like
furs,
short
like
skirt.
A fur stole. And he's got eyeliner. He is, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
He's like the David Bowie of Simon Belmont's.
Yeah, he's like the Goblin King, and like, and also the music is remixed by
Goblin
by,
King of Belmont.
The music in that is remixed by Yamane, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's all like techno club music. There's a track called "You Goddamn Badhead." It's so good. The original director of Dracula for X68000 was Hideo Ueda, who was also the director of Sparkster, Parodius, Axelay, and Sexy Parodius. So he was a dude who knew his action games. I don't know that he did a lot on X68000. But he was kind of all over the place. And in any case, he was just like, let's bring that sort of arcade mentality, like the really challenging design. Let's bring that to Castlevania and do something new and fun. And then Koji Igarashi was the producer, overseer on the remake. And the remake doesn't change too much. It gives you the new music. It gives you a new Simon sprite. But I don't think it's just like a remix, right? It's not like a total top to bottom recreation.
When you play the arranged version, it's easier. I think, if I recall correctly,
it could be. Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to be more difficult than
because I ended up playing them both like at the same time, and I got further in the arranged version for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. But it's I would say the ultimate version of the original Castlevania. Like, there's something really wonderful about the purity of the NES game and the precision, but you know, just the elaboration and the really complex visuals and just all the stuff they add to the X68000 game and to Chronicles really it's like the proper realization of that game. And the crazy thing is there's only a 7-year difference between them, not even 7 years, October 1986 to July 1993. But it just shows you how far game tech and game design had come in that time.
I mean, and also in the span, if you think about all these games, like the variations on a theme of like a very like 5 iterations here of one concept, they're all fairly different. And you didn't see a lot of that happening in that space from other publishers. Like, you know, there was a lot of sequels, a lot of like spin-offs, but not a lot of like, let's try this same thing again from a slightly different point of view.
Yeah. But,
yep.
Yeah.
So let's wrap this podcast up because I don't feel like we need to belabor the point. But I would like to ask, if you were to remake Castlevania one more time, what would you do? What would it be?
I would actually like to see the MSX version realized in a way that is not crappy, because I am at heart more than anything a Metroidvania fan, as much as I love the old action Castlevanias. And I'm really intrigued by the idea they have going. Just the idea of exploring the first iteration of Castlevania as an adventure game. And if they can make that not crappy and expand upon it, as you said, even if just M2 takes it and, you know, gives it a good spit shine, that'll be good enough for me. I'd like to see that done. I really would.
Shane?
I mentioned earlier that I would like to see a remake of Super Castlevania 4, and I do kind of mean that. So that's one thing. But
I would
also
like to see that.
At the same time, I think like if you wanted to go back to the original Castlevania, I think, you know, if we get like a next generation of VR that's a little more freed from clunkiness, and like, I think the idea of like going through Castlevania in like a VR first-person world with a whip would be kind of fun.
That'd be
actually pretty
awesome. I'd get really motion sick and barf everywhere, but I'd still do it.
Right, if you kind of made it like fitnessy too. I don't know, something crazy. Just Castlevania VR.
I would not have thought of that, but okay. Yeah, I'm on the same page as Nadia. I would like to see, you know, basically like take the X68000 remake of Castlevania and apply that ethos to the MSX game. So it would be better looking, it would be better constructed, and while it would still be challenging, it would the challenge would come from fair design and not from BS like, hey, my whip doesn't have much of a hitbox, and also every enemy takes like 20 hits to take down, and that's not very fun, and the jump controls kind of suck. Like, clean up all those things and just bring out the gem that is hidden in this disgusting ore. And that's what I want.
This pile of slag.
In any case, I don't know if there is a future for Castlevania. You hear rumors. They did just release a mobile game. Is that out yet, actually? I played it at TGS.
Is that the Symphony of the Night one?
It's very much in the Harmony of Despair style. Harmony of Despair, like the multiplayer.
I think my husband was playing that and he said it was all right.
Yeah, it's okay. Like, it's got the gacha loop of mobile games, as to be expected, but it seemed okay from what I played of it. Better than it could have been. But I guess, between that and the Castlevania collection for Switch and Xbox and PlayStation, it does mean that Konami hasn't totally forgotten about the franchise.
I think the Netflix show is bringing a lot of young, new fans too. Yeah. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
So yes, I would like to get a proper revival of Castlevania, not a Lords of Shadow sequel or reboot. Just like give us old school Castlevania. Don't belabor the point. Don't go too far with it. Just give us a good Castlevania game and that would be fine. That's all I want. All right.
I can live with that.
So I think that about wraps it up for this episode. Thanks, Shane. Thanks, Nadia, for joining me. Can you let us know, as always, where we can find you online, Shane?
You can find me on Twitter at ShaneWatch, all one word. It's mostly politics or food pictures or Jar Jar fandom, video games, that kind of stuff.
Nadia?
I am on Twitter at Nadia Oxford. That's all one word. And you can also find my writing at usgamer.net. And as I mentioned earlier, I am the co-host of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. So please join us for that. It's pretty cool, I think.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite. And you can find me writing and podcasting and so on and so forth for Limited Run Games. Also, I do that YouTube series, Video Works. So you can look my name up and you'll find me there and you can see videos about Castlevania games. I've done several. And Retronauts, of course, you can find on your favorite podcatcher for free. You can also subscribe to us through Patreon and get early access to all our episodes that are released on the public feed. And there's also exclusive episodes if you subscribe at the $5 per month level. There are other special treats that you can get at higher tiers, but that's the basics. It's a good value proposition. I highly recommend it. It'll make your life better and your feet smell better. So you should definitely do it. That is not a guarantee. But yes, go to patreon.com/retronauts and you can find us. And I think that's about it. So just keep an eye on the podcast feed and on the videos and on everything we do, because we'll keep talking about Castlevania. We don't shut up about it. And I'm sure we'll reconvene at some point to talk about more Castlevania. So please look forward to it.